Okay, so I take a very broad view of allostery. I would say that I liked the definition that Rob Phillips used the other morning, that basically you have ligand binding that elicits some functional change, right? I tend to be a little bit broader than that and say not only ligand binding, but it could also be something like post-translational modification, or it could be regulation by, say, a protein-protein interaction at a particular interface where you have some binding that modulates activity of the protein. So basically the idea is we want to understand something about how allosteric regulation evolves in proteins. And I guess just to back up for a moment, one of the themes that we've kind of seen in the meeting is the idea that cellular function and fitness comes from the collective cooperative action of many underlying proteins. And so this can be accomplished through allosteric regulation, where say you have a protein that binds to and regulates the activity of a second protein. You can have proteins that assemble into large physical complexes. And then you can also have proteins that interact not necessarily physically, but functionally through different metabolic intermediates. And so this is what I talked about last week, and today I'll really be talking about this first case of allosteric regulation between proteins. And in particular, can we try to understand something about what information in the amino acid sequence really encodes these interactions? How are they specified? And how does allosteric regulation evolve in proteins in the first place? So the reason why evolution of allosteric regulation is not necessarily obvious is because allosteric regulation requires cooperative, coordinated action of spatially distributed amino acids. So here is an example. I'm showing a little PDZ domain. So this is a little protein that binds a particular peptide ligand here. And so it's known that there are particular residues around the ligand binding site that are important for ligand binding affinity, but this guy also has an allosteric site on the backside of the protein. And so if you have a protein-protein interface that forms over here, that this can actually regulate the peptide binding affinity on this site. And so really, I think this is kind of a molecular scale version of evolution of complexity, right? Because how do you evolve allosteric regulation, a thing that's function would appear to depend on multiple amino acids, through this really kind of naive stepwise process, right? And then evolution seems to find this relatively easy task. This was actually something that was, I think, pointed out really nicely in a review by John Currien and David Eisenberg, that when you look at a lot of these protein families, you find that they do allosteric regulation, and they've come up with a diversity of solutions to how they do allosteric regulation. So they don't always use particularly the same surface to accomplish allosteric regulation. And one of the examples they give, hooks back a little bit to Matt's talk. He showed us this kind of diversity of transcription factor structures. And so they show this for homeobox domains, and basically that they all bind DNA, but the actual allosteric interactions that you get between these molecules is mediated by sort of different parts of the protein and different family members. So, you know, how do you evolve this in the first place, and how is it that evolution finds this trait, it would seem, sort of easy to evolve because it can be evolved multiple times in a protein family at different surfaces? And so the idea was to start really with an approach from trying to understand how proteins are built. And this is using coevolution to map constraints between amino acid residues. And so here the idea is, if we want to know kind of the pattern or interactions between amino acids within a protein, then what you do is you take your protein of interest, you go and you collect up a sequence alignment for this protein. So here, each one of these lines represents a particular sequence, and the columns are positions. And then you look at the covariance of amino acid frequencies at site I and J, and then you can build a big matrix of how every pair of amino acids in the protein are co-evolving with each other, or at least how they're covarying with each other.
How do you define this, like, what's the unit of measure of how different two amino acids are at the site?
Yeah, so here, there is no basically we're just looking at raw frequencies. There's no notion of kind of like a substitution matrix or like an alanine is very, very different than an arginine. We're just saying, what is the frequency and does the frequency at site I covary with site J or not? So I've also tucked some slides at the end of my presentation about the math that goes into this if anyone wants to know more about how this analysis works. But basically the idea is that we produce at the end this matrix, right? And so this matrix is organized from the N-terminus of the protein to the C-terminus of the protein, and every single pixel corresponds to the kind of strength of coevolution between these positions. And then we can analyze this matrix to pull out the groups of amino acids that are strongly coevolving with each other. And this is something that we're now calling the sector, which is a unit of the protein that is non-randomly coevolving.
It looks like you string it out along the primary sequence, along the edges of your matrix.
Yeah, so here... Right, so you can take this matrix and you can cluster it, right? And basically, and find groups of things that are really strongly co-evolving. So there's a couple of like interesting things I should point out about this matrix already. So the way it's color-coded, red means there's a high degree of covariation, blue means there's very little. So you already notice that a lot of this matrix is blue. So there's many, many sites in the protein that seem to be evolving relatively independently, that they don't care who their neighbor is. And then you see that the positions that are co-evolving with each other don't have any kind of obvious arrangement on the primary sequence, right? So they're kind of scattered throughout the protein. And then the interesting thing is basically what we do instead of clustering this matrix is to do an eigenvalue eigenvector decomposition on it and find the eigenmodes. And those correspond to our groups of collectively evolving positions. And then the interesting thing is if you take those and map them on the structure, they form these kind of physically contiguous and three-dimensional patterns. So here is an example. This is dihydrofolate reductase, which basically is space-filling representation. And the catalytic site is here, so you bind substrate here and your cofactor here. And you can take a slice through this, and the sector positions are colored blue, and so you can see that it forms this kind of spider-like network within the protein structure, where you get these groups of amino acids that are physically contiguous, that are co-evolving with each other, and yet it's sparse. So it's really only about 20 to 30% of the protein structure that gets captured in this co-evolving unit. Sectors more generally. So I showed this example of dihydrofolate reductase on the previous slide. But this has also been looked at, say, for serine proteases, another enzyme family, and also for the PDZ domain. Here I'm just showing three examples. And for all the cases that we've looked at thus far, you can basically take the structure, you can take a slice through it, right? That's what I'm showing down here. And you find that the sectors seem to empirically share these kind of three physical properties. So one is that they're sparse, so they're kind of really only 20 to 30% of the protein structure. They're physically contiguous, so they form a unit in the tertiary structure. And they connect the active site to distant surface sites. So for example, in the PDZ domain, we see that our sector connects up this ligand binding pocket to a surface on the backside of the domain, which we know is allosterically regulated. In the case of serine proteases, we again see that it has this kind of distributed architecture. And in DHFR, we also see this kind of sparse, physically contiguous architecture with these distant surface sites. And this is kind of interesting because, oh yeah, Matt's
question. Is physically contiguous, is that built into the definition or is it like a feature that you observe?
Yeah, that's an important point. So we don't use it to define what they are. So basically, in defining it, all we do is we have some statistics from analyzing the sequence, right? And then basically we pull out the groups of things that are really strongly co-evolving, and it's the finding that they are actually physically contiguous when you map them on the structure.
That's a little surprising to me, because I would think co-evolving here and here, and then maybe there's no selection for co-evolving on the amino acids in between them on the periphery. But have you found that there's always a direct connection between the two regions?
Yeah, that there's always seems to be some kind of physical linkage that kind of wires these things up. Yeah.
And have you, maybe you'll get this, have you tested the effect of setting a random loop to break up the physical loop?
Yeah, this is exactly where we're going.
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
Does this work well for that are on certain kinds of proteins or evolutionary distances than others?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this method works best when you have a sort of good amount of sequence diversity. So the sequence alignments that work well going into this are things where you have sort of an average pairwise sequence identity on the order of maybe 20 to say 40 to 50% of your amino acid sequence identity. It's low, okay. For most families, if there are things that appear, for example, in bacteria, you can get that kind of diversity. So, so for example, for DHFR, metabolic enzyme that it is, our average pairwise sequence identity and alignment is about 30%. The place where so far I think it needs a little bit more work to be able to be applied there is when you get into things that really only occur in like higher eukaryotes and the sequence identities are sort of closer to 80 to 90% identical to each other.
So it wouldn't work for actin then or some of these highly conserved cytoskeleton?
Yeah, we sort of started to try and look at some more conserved things. For really conserved stuff, I think it's tough because you just don't have enough signal in terms of what's actually changing at the pairs of positions. Yeah, but I think it's interesting to think about ways that you could sort of modify the existing methods to try to deal with that, for sure. Yeah.
Do you know if these sectors themselves evolve? Like, say, if you do the analysis of the bacterial DHFR and the eukaryotic DHFR, do you see?
Yeah,
sectors on the protein, so.
That's a great question. So indeed, I have done exactly that. So looked at sectors for eukaryotes and prokaryotes, and you do see a little bit of divergence in the sector definition that you get for the eukaryotes versus the prokaryotes. There's a large extent of overlap. There's some modifications. There's a really nice paper from Peter Wright's group a few years ago showing that the human DHFR uses a different enzymatic mechanism. It has different conformational changes it does associated with catalysis. So it's kind of tempting to speculate that those are the changes that are associated with like modifying the dynamics, but it's only speculation at this point. Yeah.
So you don't use biologic at all to correct, you just take the raw data?
So, okay, so what do we do about this problem of phylogenetic noise, right, that Casey introduced? So here the idea is,
Well, it wasn't so much noise that I was thinking, but just sort of the imbalance. You have 1,000 mammals in there and one bacteria.
Yeah. So there are two things that are done to try to, in some ways, minimize the effects of phylogeny. One is that there's a set of sequence weights that get applied. So basically you can, we set some cutoff between sequences on identity. So if you have two sequences that are within 80% sequence identity to each other, when you compute this matrix, they each count as a half. So you have a number of effective sequences that's smaller than the number of total sequences because you sort of downweight things that are oversampled in the alignment. The other thing that's done is when we actually compute the covariation here, instead of what we're calculating isn't really just a raw covariance between the frequencies of the amino acids, it's actually weighted by a conservation-based term. And so the idea is to try to emphasize coevolution between more highly conserved positions in the alignment and to not consider as strongly positions that are sort of less conserved, with the idea that those less conserved positions will be potentially more subject to phylogenetic noise. Yeah.
Well, if you're the nice, I would think it would be the opposite. But if the only possibility at a given site is one of three amino acids or two, it's either going to be a serum or three amino protein doesn't work, then you might get artifactual sort of variation with or site, or just because it would then appear to covariate with a ton of different sites.
Okay, so here the idea is, and this is an interesting question, and Andrew actually has a paper on this that's related, but I think the idea with the weighting scheme is it's all about where you are looking for information in the protein family. And so with this weighting scheme, right, we're emphasizing the really more conserved positions, and the idea is to look for things that correspond to kind of older functional divergences in the protein family, with the idea that those reflect some, like, the really kind of core conserved properties of the protein. You can also do this in the absence of weights, and in that case, you're looking at things that are really sort of rapidly changing, say, in the leaves of your tree, and that might tell you sort of a different set of things about the protein family. So for example, actually, if you look at a coevolution between histidine kinase response regulator pairs in bacterial signaling, basically they form some protein-protein interfaces, and protein or bacteria usually have some complement of histidine kinase response regulator pairs. And if you look at coevolution in this way, where you're looking at high degrees of conservation, what you pull out are sector-like things for the histidine kinase and the response regulator, but you don't pull out anything about what's co-evolving at the protein-protein interface. If you do it without the weights, then what you find are sort of things that are rapidly changing at the interface that are presumably responsible for, like, tuning specificity of the pairs, or more like rapidly changing in any particular like clade of the protein family. So, yeah, I think basically the idea is with the conservation weighting, you can kind of tune like what sort of information you're looking for, like really old conserved things in the protein family or sort of newer functional features. Yeah.
Did you see, so speaking of newer functional features, if you're looking at that broad a range, could you pull out different sectors in different lineages that have evolved a regulatory mechanism using a different set of residues?
Yeah, okay, so you can do that. And actually, I'll show an example near the end of this for HSP70. And there we find a group of positions that make a sector that we think is involved in allosteric regulation. And those positions only form a sector in kind of a clade that has the allosteric regulation. And then there's a clade that's not allosteric and they don't have it. So. Yeah.
But it would be cool if you could find two clades that both had allosteric regulation, but
like different.
Come in different, yeah.
Yeah.
You could pull out sectors that
correspond to same.
Multiple solutions to the problem.
Yes, I will show something kind of along those lines in a little bit. Yeah. Okay. So. Yeah, so we find these sector positions within the protein. And so the kind of interesting thing is we find, you know, in cases where there's known allostery, like this PDZ domain, we see that the allosteric site gets kind of hooked up to the ligand binding site over here. But we also find this architecture for proteins with no known allosteric regulation. So like in the case of DHFR, there's no known allosteric modifiers, and yet we see this kind of pattern of coevolution within the protein structure. Okay, and so,
Kim?
Yeah.
Does that have anything to do with the dynamics that is proposed to be involved in?
Yes.
These substrates together?
Yeah, so actually in DHFAR, it turns out, okay, so in DHFAR we're actually like lucky because so many people worked on it. And people have, so Peter Wright's lab in particular has shown that basically there's kind of five conformational states that it proceeds around whenever it's doing its catalytic reaction. And they did CPMG NMR experiments to basically look at what positions were undergoing kind of slow conformational exchange. So these are positions that are exchanging sort of millimicrosecond timescale fluctuations. And so those are all these orange spheres here. And we can take these orange spheres and correlate them to the positions we see that are in the sector. And so here what I'm doing is I'm showing all the sector positions in space filling. And so the orange ones are the ones that overlap with this guy. And then the blue ones are sector positions that aren't in that case. And then there's a handful of things that are exchanging that aren't in the sector. But the bottom line is we find quite a high degree of overlap between the two. So it's tempting to speculate that the sector is sort of kind of the structural basis for these conformational fluctuations. Okay, so here's the idea. We sort of look at these and empirically see that they have this kind of internal architecture that we can see with these sector things. And so the idea is that if the sector really is kind of groups of things that are co-evolving some kind of cooperative mechanism in the protein, maybe the sector gives a way to kind of wire up multiple protein surface sites to the active site. And so this is just kind of a cartoon of the idea, but the idea is if you have something like DHFAR and you have particular positions that are really strongly co-evolving, that potentially these positions are now sort of poised to do allosteric regulation, and that these could be sort of hotspots where you can now gain allosteric control of the protein.
Can you say that
again? Oh, yeah. Okay, so the idea is that, so we find these groups of amino acid positions that are strongly co-evolving in our sequence alignment, right? And the idea is we're using the coevolution to kind of infer that these are positions that are physically or functionally interacting in some way, right? And that's what's giving rise to the coevolution. And so we find these coevolutionary networks. And so the idea is if this really physically corresponds to a cooperative mechanism in the protein, then the idea would be now if I were to, say, like poke this protein here, that this would be a position that could regulate the active site. But if I were to poke it over here, it would not be. It would be sort of decoupled, right?
So maybe because of your title, I was assuming that this coevolution was already because of allosteric regulation.
Yeah.
And so you're arguing that, no, it's intrinsic to the structural requirements of the protein, and later on the allosteric, and how do you separate those?
Yeah, how do you separate those? That's a really good question. Okay. So, I mean, I think one piece of evidence is that we do see this architecture fairly ubiquitously, at least in the sort of 30 case studies that we've seen, regardless of whether or not these protein families have known allosteric regulators, right? That seems to be a fairly common kind of structural layout.
Is there some kind of experimental scheme that would allow you to ask whether a given enzyme has allostery without having to know what the regulators were?
Ooh.
Like, can you estimate how many states the enzyme can be in order to explain the kinetics or something?
That's a great question. I think most of the experiments that I think about with people usually measuring allostery, they do know what the regulator is.
No, right.
But yeah, so what I'm going to show is basically a way to kind of like blindly probe if there's allostery there next. But But then it does give this kind of chicken and the egg question, right? So if we're saying that allostery evolves on top of this, like what gives rise to this architecture? And so there's an idea that this is kind of the natural solution for protein structures for systems that have to evolve under fluctuating environments. And so the idea is if you're evolving in a case where your environment is changing a lot, that you want some positions to be more adaptable and be able to, when you have a mutation, have some large effect. But then when you want other sets of positions to be more robust, and so if you introduce a mutation there for it to have relatively little effect. And so what one would like to do is to do sort of a long-term forward evolution experiment where you take particular proteins and you fluctuate the environment at different rates and look to see if that gives you out things that are built more like this or less like this. That would be kind of the dream.
I'm really bothered by explanations that somehow the system can anticipate a need for a mutation down the road. So I can see it, you know, in cases of a fluctuating environment where you need to change regulation from one place to another or something like that. But I just don't see how that protein, how the system can anticipate that
a mutation down the road might be useful at this point, so it should be wired up.
Oh, I don't.
More general question, I get this question all the time of, you know, whether promiscuous enzymes are promiscuous because they might be useful in the future.
Right.
And I usually think no, because evolution can't anticipate, and this sounds like the same kind of issue.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily that it's anticipating these things, but rather that this architecture is kind of the product of all of its past experience and history, right? And so if its past experience and history has been that, like, you know, every few generations it has to adapt to bind some new ligand or adapt to live in, I don't know, a hotter environment or something, right? And that it has to change all the time, then the ones that live are going to be the ones that are better able to adapt, right? So I would say that there is not anticipating, but there would be a selection on being able to be adaptable.
I mean, I guess it seems like the most direct way of saying that is, you imagine that the environment changes, you make cysteine 35 changes to a 3D. The protein is somewhat better than it used to be, but it will be still better if aspartate 86 changes to a gluten, right? And because they change in some period of time together, they end up showing up in this analysis for correlated mutation because there's some functional drive between those things. Mm-hmm. And those residues turn out to be in some physically connected part of the protein because they're controlling its structure. Nothing's been said that says anything about anticipatory evolution.
Right, so I agree with all of that.
But I think that's...
But that wasn't quite
what... Well, I think that's sort of what Kim's saying. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I think that's a fair statement. Wait, but there's something that I said that you don't quite agree with. It's not quite what Andrew said.
The idea of the advantage of having certain parts that were less vulnerable to be mutated, therefore could be mutatable, but that would be advantageous in and of itself. But I think
yeah. And I do think that's true. I think that within proteins, because they do have to survive in a case where things are kind of fluctuating and they are subject to mutation, that you don't want to build something where every time you mutate it, it breaks, because that's just going to get selected out really quickly.
But that's an answerable question in the sense that because you and other people have changed every amino acid to every other amino acid, right, and analyzed the functions, you can ask, are mutations that you make in sector positions more or less deleterious than average? Because the alternative argument is, all the guys who aren't colored blue are actually, many of them are less important. The guys in the catalytic site don't get colored blue because they're 100% conserved, mm-hmm. right? But the much of the colorless part is actually less conserved than the blue part. And mutations there are actually less likely to have effects, deleterious effects. And like I'm saying, because you guys have done the systematic study, the answer is knowable.
But
do the mutations in the sector positions are they more or less likely to destroy the function?
And you would kind of
they're more likely to modify the function, which could be destroy it or could be change it to do something else.
Well, couldn't these sectors and kind of just be the residues that are playing the key roles in stability and folding? Is that if you don't fold it correctly, you lose the function even though the catalytic site is technically
conserved, yeah. Okay, so you can do experiments where, and this is really kind of a separate line of talks, where you go and design synthetic versions of a protein using this matrix as your guide, right? And so what you can do is you can design up a suite of synthetic proteins that don't have natural sequences, but the alignment obeys these statistics. So you maintain a certain pattern of conservation and coevolution. And if you take those proteins and you go and make them in the lab, the result is that those things do fold and function roughly like their natural counterparts, at least in the couple of cases I tried. Okay, so basically what happens is that you go and make them in the lab and they can bind ligand and that they fold and they are reasonably stable.
But are those the cyan guys where you've co-evolved positions, or if you just break one position in that loop?
Mm-hmm.
So I would expect if you broke a position in the loop, you might screw something up.
Yeah, so you can make mutations in this, and you do, those do, okay, so there's two things.
Which isn't consistent with the idea that these are places where you can anticipate being able to fluctuate to a new function. Because if you hit one of these, you've lost your shooting function.
So what I would say is that these positions are positions that have a functional effect. And that functional effect could be that it totally breaks the enzyme, right? It could be a loss of function thing. But these are also going to be the positions, right, around the active site that might be key things to tune to change your specificity or, say, change the rate at which you do the reaction, right? So they could be things that totally break it, or they could be things that have some capacity to sort of tune the activity of the enzyme or the ligand binding domain. Whereas these guys out here are going to have much less of an effect on the protein activity, good or bad.
Right. I agree with that. I'm still stuck on the anticipation thing, though.
Okay.
You can go on and I'll let it go.
So we've been discussing the fact that these mutating these blue residues would have a strong effect, but you could already predict function based on the alignment alone. The most conserved residues would be the ones with the stronger effects. So what's special about the blue residues is that you have co-dependencies between them.
Yes.
So there has to be something, that an experiment that you do that actually is playing around with the co-dependencies, not just mutating one residue, because that you can already figure out from the alignment alone, from rates of evolution.
Okay, so I would say that in general, if you look at conservation, that is going to tell you about things like active site positions, for sure. But the things that you're going to miss are going to be potentially positions out here on the surface, which might be strongly co-evolving with things in here, but are not necessarily themselves strongly conserved, right? And those will be positions that will be kind of missing in your standard just analysis of conservation. The second thing is that you can definitely do experiments to change more than one thing at a time. And that's really the idea with these design experiments.
Yeah, so that's where the predictions become interesting, where you can differentiate what's happening in the blue sectors relative to the white sectors.
Yeah.
Because if you want to destroy the enzyme, just destroy the most conserved residue.
Often, so if I mean, one of the things is, I guess the way I think about it is slightly different. So we've been talking about this as though the blue sector is important for the function being the chemical function, right? But that's not necessarily the only function. You can think of a protein as the structure itself is a function of the sequence. So these sectors represent something intrinsic about what evolution is constrained by, right? So for example, you have three different sectors in the serine proteases. That's one of the things they find. And one of the sectors is a structural fold. One of them represents the chemical activity, and the other one is another part of the protein. Right? So you can imagine sectors are a functional definition, they're a vector.
Yeah, I understand.
Now,
the difference is that here you can evolve the blue sector if you change two things at the same time,
right? But
which is not the same. So that's where the interesting difference comes from. Otherwise, if you're just looking for one thing that's important, you already get that from there.
So not necessarily, right? Because one of the things is, for example, there are proteins in ion channels, because my other lab works on them. So there are ion channels that are modulated by different chemicals, right? And different species ion channels have different chemical modulators that effectively act in the same site. So there is an understanding that the way you communicate to the pore is similar, but the actual thing that it binds there can be very, very different.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So the binding site is kind of hard to know based on just simple conservation. Because there's no reason to believe that the conservation of the site is represented by the
water. Well, I was doing the opposite reasoning. If you want to kill the enzyme, you could already look at the conservation medium when we were discussing the
mutations.
Okay. All right. Okay, so the basic idea is here that we have a sector. We've gotten it for whatever reason for free, right? That this is just part of how the protein is built. And so given the sector, you can have these particular positions that start to act as hotspots to get allosteric regulation. And so the experiment that you would like to do is to basically do something that I'm going to call a domain insertion and scan. So you're going to take your enzyme. So here our enzyme, our output domain is going to be dihydrofolate reductase. And then we're going to take as our input domain this little light sensing domain from plants. So this is a domain called LOVE2, and it basically has a chromophore that responds to light. And we can attach it here. And then the idea is if we attach it to a non-sector position, then we would predict that we get no regulation. And then if we take LOVE2 and we plug it into one of these sector sites, then our hypothesis would be that we would now start to see a light-regulated enzyme because we've sort of established communication between these two domains. But to really do this thoroughly, you don't really want to do just two sites. What you actually want to do is this. You want to take this light-sensing domain, and you want to march it around the surface of the protein, and you want to put it at every single surface-accessible site, and then just ask comprehensively, where do we get light-dependent allosteric regulation of DHFR, right? So which sites show light dependence and which sites don't? Okay, so experimentally, like practically how this works is we have LOVE2, which is this our input domain. It's a light sensing domain from plants. And conveniently for the purpose of this experiment, the NNC termini of this protein are really close together. And what happens when it's activated by light is that you get this conformational change in response to light, and this helix translocates off the back of the domain. And so what we do is we take this domain and we plug it into the backbone of dihydrofolate reductase. And so what I'm showing here is in spheres all the surface accessible positions on DHFR. And then what we do is we make a library of chimeras where you take LOVE2 and you insert it after each one of these surface accessible residues on the protein. So you get a library of 70 total fusion proteins. And then we're going to test to see which of these gives light dependent enzyme activity in vivo. And the in vivo aspect of this is really for two reasons. One is practical, right? We have a big library, we want some kind of screen that'll be quick. And then the second thing is, we want some way to evaluate what do we consider to be a good allosteric effect. Like, what should be the cutoff for that? And so here the idea is we're going to just let the organism, in our case E. coli, tell us what's a big allosteric effect, whether or not it has some physiological effect that we can measure. Okay, so the way the assay works is we have a E. coli strain that's knocked out for DHFR. And we can show that basically we can put back in DHFR enzymes with different activities, and that growth rate is really strongly dependent on the activity of the enzyme. So basically what we're using is growth rate as a proxy for the catalytic activity of DHFR. And then what we do is we take all 70 of our DHFR LOVE2 fusions, and we grow them in two conditions. We grow them in the dark, and then we grow them in the light. And then what we want to look for are fusions that basically grow differently in the dark than in the light. And so the idea is if there's no allosteric communication between the two, they should have exactly the same activity in the dark and the light and the same growth rate. And if there is allosteric communication, then we should now see that they grow with different rates in these two flasks. And so then the only other technical trick is we grow these in a mixed population. So we're using next-gen sequencing to basically measure the growth rates of everything in a mixed population. I introduced that on Thursday, but I can do it again if anyone wants to talk about that. So, okay. So first of all, does it work? So just to consider an example. So we have one particular fusion where LOVE2 has been inserted at a sector-connected site in DHFR. And we see that in this case, in response to light, you get a roughly two-fold increase in K-Hydr. So this is the catalytic step of DHFR. And then we can do some controls where we basically take LOVE2 and we can remove this C-terminal domain that actually does the conformational change, or we can make a mutant in LOVE2 that makes it unresponsive to light. And in both of these cases, you lose the light-dependent effect. Okay, so biochemically, we can measure that there's about a twofold effect. Do we see anything in vivo? And so here, what I'm plotting is the results of the in vivo assay. So we've got time on the x-axis, and then this is the relative allele frequency over time. So in the dark, you see that 121, this insertion, and R2 controls all grow about the same. And then in the light, you see that you get a little bump. And then in fact, this guy grows about 15% faster in the light than it does in the dark. And so the idea is now we have a readout where we can look for things that actually have a little bit of allosteric regulation, right? Okay, so what about all of our surface sites? So we can do this for our library of 70 things. And here what we're looking at is the distance in the growth rate, or sorry, difference in the growth rate between the lit and the dark states for all of our 70 different mutants. And you can basically see that there's a handful of positions that give significant lit-dark differences. One of the things that I think is interesting is we actually get changes in both directions. So we get things that are faster in light than dark, things that are faster in dark than light. And we can go and do some checks. So we can make sure that these in vivo growth-based measurements reflect biochemical activity in vitro. So this is just showing three of the most highly regulated constructs. Basically, we can measure the ratio of their catalytic activities in the light versus dark, and it seems to map well to what we measure as their growth rate differences. Yeah?
So I know that one of the ways in which the sectors is a little bit fuzzy in the way it's defined is there's a heuristic cutoff in terms of how you move your PC analysis, right?
Yes.
So are these the strongest in the analysis? So if you dial back or you make your analysis more stringent,
mm-hmm.
are these positions the ones that are preserved the longest in terms of the sector's definition?
Yeah, okay, so that is true. So what we did, because there is this kind of cutoff for deciding what sector versus not sector, when we looked at the association of light-dependent positions with the sector, we actually changed over a range of cutoffs to make sure that it wasn't strongly sensitive to cutoff. And in fact, most of the light-dependent positions are the strongest sector cutoff, sort of, yeah. Okay, so overall we get 14 positions that are light dependent. They're spread across the surface of the protein, and they don't really have any obvious relationship to the active site or each other, right? So we find things on the back of the protein. But all 14 of the sites are, in fact, sector connected. So here what I'm showing is our enzyme DHFR, and you can take a series of consecutive slices through it and then lay these out here at the right. And then we can see sort of the sector spanning through here, and then you see that basically these red positions are the spots where we're getting light dependence, and they really do seem to appear at these sector-connected edges. And then we can do basically a statistical test, so a Fisher-Exact test, to look at the probability of getting this distribution of light-dependent positions, and we find that it's quite significant, right? That there really is some association with the sector.
Could I go back to your other question, which was just about conservation?
Yeah.
Have somehow upweighted conservation in looking at sites.
Yes.
And so it seems like, you know, there should be a null model that says, okay, what if this was had nothing to do with the sector covariance? You just took like the most, you know, the sites with this range of conservation.
Yeah.
Can you show that like that the different set of sites and.
Yeah, okay, so they're very related measures. So in fact, actually, if you use just conservation on its own,
yeah.
It does predict a number of these sites. If you use coevolution, it's a little bit better predictor, but I would say that conservation does get you a long way there in terms of guessing what these sites would be. I think one of the things that the coevolution gives you is a sense of some hierarchy in terms of which positions are more highly coupled and which positions are sort of more weakly coupled that you don't see as strongly with the conservation. And I'm wondering how that relates to, so we're planning to do further experiments to look to see if we can optimize the light dependence for these constructs. And I'm wondering how that hierarchy will shape what positions have the most effect or the most easily optimized in terms of getting allosteric regulation out of this. But yes, conservation, I think, is also a predictor, I should say. Yeah.
So I guess one prediction you can make is that the the ones that fall in the sector, you can optimize by adding mutations in the connected sectors. The one that are outside, you can optimize them. They won't even work.
Yeah, so this
There's
is...
no solution to make them work because they're disconnected.
Exactly. So we're doing precisely that experiment right now. Okay. So we're basically taking one that's sector connected and is weakly allosteric and one that's not sector connected, and we're mutating all the positions in DHFR and asking if basically our guess is that the non-sector connected one should never be able to become allosteric, whereas the sector connected guy should be sort of a good evolvable starting point. Yeah. Okay, so we see this for DHFR with this domain insertion case, and the question is, what about other systems? So we can go and look, actually take advantage of another data set for these PDZ domains. So this is basically a small ligand binding domain. And what was done for this protein was to go and take every position and mutate it to all 20 amino acids and look to see which positions had an effect on ligand binding. And again, in this case, so now I'm showing the surface positions that have an effect on ligand binding in red, right? And so definitely you get some things along the ligand binding pocket. But you also see these allosteric positions on the surface that also have some effect on ligand binding. And again, we see that the kind of functional positions are these sector connected positions. Okay, so experimentally, we see that we can actually, that these particular sector connected positions seem to be spots where we can gain allostery relatively easily, right? So we can introduce allostery in these engineered cases or have some functional effect by mutagenesis at these sites. And so this can give us, let us propose really a model for how communication might emerge between proteins. And so this really begins with an idea from Kurian and Eisenberg in their review. And so what they proposed was that if you want to evolve a new protein-protein interface, that the kind of starting step should be some kind of colocalization or compartmentalization. And so what they propose is that basically you have some kind of colocalization event. This could be gene fusion, microcompartments, colocalization on a piece of DNA. But the bottom line is that what you're doing is you're increasing your effective local concentration. And so just by law of mass action, you should start to be able to get more binding even at lower binding affinities, just because you've upped the concentration of things around you. And so then their idea is that once you've colocalized, then you can now start to evolve an interface really through single site mutants, because you can start to get an appreciable fraction bound even with a relatively low affinity. And then eventually, you'll have a new protein-protein interface that forms. Okay, so here's the idea, is if you kind of combine this with these data, then the idea would be for natural proteins to evolve new interfaces, you would go through this kind of colocalization event. And then now, if allosteric communication between the two domains or regulation is useful, then the sites where you would start to see this regulation emerge would be particularly at these sector-connected surfaces.
Which direction was DHFR fused? I'm trying to remember. Was it originally fused and then split, or?
Yeah, it's weird. So it's only fused in protozoa. So it was split, then fused, then I guess re-split, because in most other eukaryotes, it's not fused.
Okay. Yeah, it's actually not quite.
Is that not right?
There's been multiple fusions, there's been multiple reversions.
Okay.
Because that was used to polarize the tree.
Yeah.
Right? And so in plants, say the plant group, the SAR group, then it's all fused and now it's not to be a single sort of event. And they found out there were some reversions between some of the things that. So the accusozoa that are on this side, turns out that they got fusions so really multiple times.
Okay, yeah.
I was just asking because it would be interesting.
Yeah,
I
like they actually.
Well, no, I like the modelless idea that you get two proteins near each other and then they can evolve these types of interactions. And I'm wondering how frequent is it that a big protein is broken in half and it already has those connections.
Yeah.
And then they can be maintained. I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that a common mechanism?
Yeah, I think, okay, so I will, Heisenberg and Merck.
But then I started thinking about, so I'll put a plug in for population genetics. It works really nicely in bacteria where you're haploid, right? But, you know, imagine you get rid of the hinge, right? And you're in a diploid. Right, so if you go back to their original model and you get a homodimer, for example, or header, you get the domain swapping guy over to the right because you've lost the hinge and each molecule can't reach its originally, and it's nice, you already have the interface, but now you can't reach it. Mm-hmm. So you domain swap and get the dimeric molecule. But I've always wondered, I mean, the problem is if you're a diploid, now you've got these two guys in the same cell, they're different kinds of molecules architecturally, right?
And are they going to compete with each other?
Yeah, or form aggregates, or so, you know, it could be an example where there's a problem, severe problem in heterozygous. You don't have to worry about it at all if you're a bacteria, I guess.
Well, even in the heterozygote case, I guess if you get sort of far enough along the way before you disassociate, you would think that they would still be able to form a. Yeah, an interface.
They presented this. I mean, it's a cartoon fashion, but boom, get rid of the hinge and then automatically a domain swapping dimer.
Right. Well, you can be domain swapped, or you can be a. They also propose you could just be a heterodimer, right? You don't even have to do the domain swapping step, right? So, but yeah.
I think it's a great idea. The starting point is full localization.
Yeah. Okay, so basically that's the idea, and then you can start to use these sectors as really the platform for building new allosteric regulations, right? And you can exploit these different sites, but you can have different types of regulation in a particular family. So we can sort of anecdotally see things that look like this pathway in particular protein families. So this is a case of HSP70, so a chaperone. And in this case, we have something, that really is this case. So these guys are a fusion where you've got an ATP binding domain here and the substrate binding domain over here. And it's known that ATP binding here allosterically regulates substrate binding affinity here. And we find that we get a single network of co-evolving residues that really links up the ATP binding domain to the substrate binding domain.
It's a member of the same family as actin and hexokinase, right?
Just be silly.
Like it's the same overall architecture. I thought the claim was that they came from ultimately common ancestors.
Yes. Okay.
And if that was true, that fusion must have occurred way long ago because MRFB is a prokaryotic
Right. I mean, this may be a very old fusion. The interesting thing about this family is that there's also a class of HSP110s, which look like this, but are many of them are not allosteric. And so you can see that there's actually a difference in that the non-allosteric ones don't have this pattern of coevolution, but the allosteric ones do. So the other, you can also see things that look roughly like this. So basically, this is a case where you have CDC42 GDPase, and you have a nucleotide binding site over here, and this PAR6 PDZ domain over here, and you actually get regulation of the PDZ binding site by this nucleotide binding site, and again, you see that their sectors seem to connect at this protein-protein interface. And we've just started to look at sectors at the level of cellular systems. So this is, I guess, really new data. Looking at coevolution among elements in the flagellar motor. So this is particularly looking at three proteins, Fly N, Fly M, and Fly G, that form the torque generation ring. So this part of the ring basically undergoes a coordinated conformational change to switch from going clockwise to counterclockwise. And so these three proteins kind of, they assemble one on top of the other, and then they multimerize to have about 30 subunits that make this larger ring. I should say that this this particular model of how they're assembled is based on docking crystal structures into cryo-EM data. So I should say this model is potentially kind of contentious. But we see that basically when we map this sector on here, that it forms kind of a contiguous path that goes along these three proteins, and we get a strong coevolutionary signal from residues all the way in fly G to positions all the way down in fly N, right? So we see coevolution throughout this kind of three protein unit.
Looks like that's a large percentage of the surface of fly N.
Okay, so it's not true. I need to work on how to make better figures of this. This is again about 30% of the protein that's compressed in the sector. It only appears that way because the remainder of the protein is not being shown as space-filled. Yeah.
You said that you see strong coevolution signals between positions in fly G and fly N. So that means even if you concatenate the proteins, you actually see cross signals. It's
yes.
Not just that the sectors of individual proteins are surface connected, but the sectors themselves seem to show patterns of coevolution.
Across all three. Yeah, absolutely. As a control, we took fly G and we concatenated it to DHFR to make sure we didn't see a signal, and that seems to be true. So that gives me some confidence that this is reasonable. Yeah.
I mean, basically it suggests that they always function together.
Yes.
Right? Because that presumably would be why you would break the coevolution if not.
Yeah, if they were not actually assembling in this way, right? Absolutely. Okay, so we see that these sector-connected surface sites are really hot spots for allosteric regulation in these engineered systems. And based on this, we propose this model for how allosteric regulation might evolve. But then the question is, are natural proteins following this principle, right? We can show that we get these hotspots engineered. And so the idea is we can now go and systematically examine this in a protein family that's really known for regulatory diversity. So we can take the protein kinases. And it's well known that kinases have a diversity of different regulatory modes, right? So there's a number of different phosphorylation sites that can play in particular kinase family members. Some kinases are regulated by dimerization along the backside of the domain. You can have regulation by cyclins in particular family members, right, or scaffolding proteins. So here, basically, what I'm showing are just these different kind of like Easter egg colors of different known binding or regulatory sites across the kinase family. And so the question is, are these particular regulatory sites really coming up at these sector-connected surfaces? And so to look at this, basically what I did was to look at 10 kinases chosen to span sort of a broad distribution of the kinome tree and collected up mutational data. This is by no means all the mutational data available for kinases, but the idea was to collect sort of good experimental data across a diversity of kinases, and then ask, do these functional mutations that perturb regulation really associate with these sector-connected surfaces? So we built a big table. And then in individual kinase families, we in fact see that these functional mutations are sector-connected. So for example, we can look at this FES tyrosine kinase. I'm showing again in red the mutations that have some functional effect. The yellows are known phosphorylation sites that regulate activity. In this case, FES kinase is allosterically regulated by this SH2 binding domain, and there's been mutations in the SH2 domain that also perturb allosteric regulation of FES. And so we see that these functional positions are sector-connected. The same is true for this FO85 cyclin-dependent kinase. So we see mutations at the cyclin kinase interface that are sector-connected. But if you look at any particular kinase, the association of mutations with sector-connected surfaces isn't statistically significant, right? Because any particular kinase is just using, you know, one or maybe two sites that are being used in regulation. So then what happens is now if you go and look across the diversity of kinases, you can go and map these mutants onto a representative kinase structure, and we find that 27 out of these 32 positions are sector connected. So in fact, it appears that by sort of sampling over the diversity of regulatory mechanisms that kinases use, that you can actually find many of these sector-connected surface sites. And so the proposal is that in the kinases that you have a sort of diversity of regulation that's possible through this conserved cooperative architecture. And so in any particular kinase family member, you might be using one or two of these sites. But then in principle, you have a lot of allostthat's kind of sitting there latent that could be used for different tasks. What's next, right? We see that basically we have a proposal for this evolutionary model, and we have some evidence from the kinases that they seem to be using this property to evolve different allosteric mechanisms. So we have kind of two things that are, I think, interesting left to do. One is optimization, and these are the experiments that Christian already asked about, which is really, can we optimize the allosteric coupling between these domains? And our hypothesis is if you have something that's sector connected, it should be tunable and optimizable. And if you have something that's not sector connected, it should be sort of a dead starting point. And so we're now doing a combination of saturation mutagenesis and some forward evolution experiments to look at the kind of optimizability of these different engineered switches. And then the second question has to do with physical mechanism, which is, so we propose this model, and the idea is, basically that we want to start to evolve these allosteric interfaces at these sector-connected sites, right? And to say that, you have to kind of invoke something. You have to say, you would see evolution at these sector-connected surfaces if allosteric communication is a kind of useful thing for the organism, like something that would be under selection. What would be nice is if you sort of get evolution at these sector-connected sites for free. And so one interesting idea for how you start to evolve regulation at particular sites comes from Josh Wan's lab at UPenn. And so what they had done was they figured out this strategy for taking proteins and encapsulating them in reverse phase micelles and doing NMR on them. And the special thing about this encapsulation protocol is when you do this, you slow down the hydration dynamics in the micelle so that you can actually measure time constants for individual waters on the protein surface. And what they found was that you actually get kind of a distribution of water time constants along the protein surface. And there's some sites of the protein where water exchanges really slowly, and there's some sites where water exchanges really quickly. And in their study that they did on ubiquitin, they found that the sites of slow water exchange correlate to the functional protein interface binding site. And so the idea is if you have slow dynamics at these particular functional surfaces, then now it's sort of entropically easy to have an interface there because you don't have to pay as much of a entropic penalty for forming a new protein-protein interface at that site. Because presumably it's less expensive to kick those waters off. So one question I think would be interesting is if these sector-connected surfaces are really sites of slow hydration dynamics. And that would suggest that potentially, if you have spots on the protein surface that have slower hydration, that would be a more evolvable site for regulation, just physically, intrinsically. So that's really it. I will thank the people who worked with me on this. So Rama Ranganathan was my postdoc advisor when I did the majority of this work. Rick McLaughlin did the work on the PDZ domain, doing the genesis of that. And then David Pincus is my collaborator on the kinase domain stuff. And that's it.
Question about sort of where all this is coming from. I'm trying to puzzle this out. So, I mean, one picture is that these sectors are connected because they're like little force chains. And this residue pushes on that one, pushes on that one. But I could imagine another scenario where, you know, you have some protein that has to do some motion, in order to function. I mean, let's say it's like a hinge, something like that, right? In order for this to work, that hinge has to, you know, sort of have to be able to go in all these conformations with kind of equal energy or something like that. So you'd imagine that that puts some constraints on the residues right at the hinge, right? And if some of them, if you have too many residues that like to be open like this, the protein won't close, and if you have too many that like to be closed, it won't open. So there's a kind of codependency of those residues, right? You want some that like it to be open and some that like it to be closed in order to be kind of balanced.
Yeah.
And that'll also give you a connected set of residues. But they're connected not because one is pushing on the neighbor, it's because they're all involved in this one motion, and somehow that hinge is, you know, by its nature is you know, a spatially connected unit. Now those seem different to me, but I'm not sure how one would know. I mean, I could imagine like doing molecular dynamics or something on these proteins and saying,
yeah.
Oh, are these, you know, these things that you call sectors, like the things that move the most or something when the protein does its function?
Right.
It sort
right.
of seemed like you had one example that was a little bit like that about the enzyme that went through the cycle.
Yeah. So I think, I can't say from this experiment that we really know the mechanism by which these things work, right? And I could imagine that actually the mechanism itself might actually be a little bit degenerate, and you could have a sector in one particular protein family where it's really some coupled chain of forces, and you could have a sector in another protein family that corresponds more to some kind of state balancing, right? And it, you could get this same kind of sector architecture in potentially many different ways, right? So I don't know if you distinguish it in one case, you would be able to say that that's how it's working in all of the cases.
Would you be able to actually test that? I mean, if one subset of these mechanisms is you're actually tracing a set of sort of structural determinants of the protein, and if you do the molecular dynamics experiments just computationally, right, because everything you're going to be able to sequence and you'll have a score of how well it's going to fit, the set of coevolutionary, so one of those mutations should destabilize something, but then the compensatory one should restore the score, right?
Yes, in theory,
yeah.
Something like that. Okay, so, yeah.
So you can actually now have an assay. You should be able to just run all of your mutations through your molecular dynamics thing.
Well, it's kind of assuming that the molecular dynamics things, like,
yeah.
Work perfectly, right?
Yes,
and I guess my concern would be that for a lot of these things, that the timescale, like for DHFR, the timescale motions that we see are really long timescale thing, like microsecond to millisecond conformational transitions. And I'm not sure that MD would work well for all of those.
Well,
so
you might
be cutting edge stuff
is actually
to do, but
get use the molecular dynamics to first get your set of potential things to then go and actually test with either crystallography or NMR. You don't do all the experiments, you can sort of
I mean, yeah, the bottom line is you would like some way to be able to sort of see what kind of conformational or energetic coupling all these things have with each other, right?
Well, along the same lines, what if you take the cases where you see sectors that are arranged more or less like a string of amino acids through the protein, let's sort of some kind of linear shaped sector, and then you were to look at a residue, say, halfway down that chain,
mm-hmm.
Would knowing that residue be sufficient statistic to know the rest on either side? There's another, if you know the residue in the middle, you should then remove, you know, conditioned on that residue, you should only, maybe you would lose now the correlation spanning across it if it's really just a chain of things, you know, if it's like a chain of dominoes, right?
Oh, like if you pull that one out, you wouldn't be able to see a correlation of
it. If you fixed it, right? So like if you said, okay, like if I know domino in the middle of the chain, which conformation that, which amino acid is there, now it won't matter anymore which ones you have up to that point. The ones
yeah.
that come, right? I mean, could you sort of...
So in practice, like what happens with the with the patterns of correlations that we see, the correlations themselves don't seem to have that kind of chain-like structure where you have one thing correlated to another, but I mean,
okay.
I guess kind of by the nature of correlations, what you'll see is like a correlated block where thing A is correlated to B, C, D, and E, and then E is also correlated to the other things in its
right, but if you now look at conditional correlation, so you fix one of them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, then with
do
like,
you lose the block-like structure, or is now to separate the two disconnected blocks? So you take all the cases where you know it's a spark eight, whatever.
Yeah. I mean,
if you saw that, I would argue for a chain-like scheme.
But I think this does argue for the state argument, and this is I think a great experiment. Like, have great correlations, but break the chain right in the middle. Mm-hmm. Do something that's just one bad residue in the middle. If it's the state, that would say that one residue isn't going to matter as long as you've got a good balance of all the others.
I guess.
And the chain would say, if you get a wrong residue in the middle, you've broken the force chain. It can't work anymore.
But this is sort of an internal problem with the whole thing that I'm having a hard time getting my head around. We're co-evolving sites, right?
Yes.
So, sort of by implication, then you make a change at one site, and that sort of forces a change at another site.
But I think, okay.
Maybe I interrupted.
No. I guess I want to add one thing, and actually, I think I'm failing to understand the distinction between the state model and the chain-like thing, because at the end of the day, both of those things have to be kind of realized by thermodynamic interactions between.
This one says it's nearest neighbor effects. This says it's nearest neighbor effects, and for example, if you're in 1D, you could break those.
Okay.
One break in the chain. And the other says it's just an integral over the whole thing. Just add up all the contributions and they got to get in the right range.
Okay.
That's, I think, the nearest neighbor versus,
like local versus.
Local versus kind of global thing. It's just saying, okay.
I mean, I think the best way of doing that, I sort of share Kim's worry that although in a formal sense these are distinguishable, it might be a little harder to actually do an experiment, but it seems to me that if you really believed in the chain of transmission, as opposed to something like global flexibility, if you had two positions where you can put amino acids that are quote unquote worse, right? For a global model about flexibility or something, it shouldn't matter whether those two residues are next to each other in the chain or far apart. The delta G should add up. For a transmission model, presumably, it's much worse to put two things that can't talk to have a poor job of talking to each other right next to each other.
Yeah.
But wouldn't the two, if the model is, you buy something on land, that then modifies the structure somehow that affects the function on the other end, then it's actually the two things that are coupled. Right? And so if you break the structure, that's going to be a problem. But if you also break the binding site, so you can't break the structure, I don't know how you tease those two things apart.
So you can do an experiment, and this has been done now, where you basically have a protein that binds a particular ligand, and you can crystallize that protein both in holo and apo states, so with ligand, without ligand, right? And so, okay, this is in the case of PDC domain, so you put some ligand here, sort of bad drawing of the ligand. And basically you see that there are conformational changes associated with ligand binding here, and then you also get conformational changes for a few residues that are further removed, so sort of allosteric positions, right? So then you can go and you can make a mutation in that structure, right? And you can make something that you predict will break the sector. And what you see is that you can then bind ligand, and then you get the ligand-induced conformational change in this part, but now this part still looks like the unliganded state. And I think that would argue for, I guess, some kind of more like the force chain kind of thing, because you can sort of disrupt that with the single amino acid substitution. Yeah, but I think in general, like what you want to be able to do is to kind of see what these things are doing conformationally. And so there's actually a number of experiments now going on in Rama's lab to try to get at the collective physical dynamics of these things by doing like room temperature crystallography, where you can try to observe conformational flexibility, basically just other structural techniques or things like NMR, where you can get some sense of dynamics and how the dynamics change in response to mutation to really see what the kind of physical basis for these sectors are.
So what I think I've understood is you're saying two things. So that if you look at those blue sites in the diagram, they quite often look like chains with almost like a linear thing. But if you look at the correlation matrix, then you see blocks, so that every blue site is correlated with every blue site and not with its neighbor.
Yes, there's some hierarchy there.
So it'd be nice to see some numbers that show, for example, I mean, if you plot how strongly correlated they are with how many contacts apart they are in the structure, for example. I mean, is it really true that the far away ones are equally correlated as the near ones?
No, that's not true. I should be clear about that. Okay, so what it appears like is that the correlations themselves are, I wish I had a good figure to show this right now, are kind of hierarchical in nature. So if you take, back up to this matrix, like this matrix here, and you take that and you cluster it, then you get something that looks like this, where you have a bunch of things that are really highly coevolving, and then you have some things that are kind of weakly coupled to that. And then you might have a few things that are really weakly coupled to that. And so you have some kind of hierarchy of the correlations, where you have a kind of core of things that are really highly correlated and coevolving and do look more block-like. And then you have like a periphery that's more loosely coupled, right? And if you go and map that on the structure, it does appear to have a kind of spatial pattern where, say, these core highly coupled positions will be the things right around the binding site. And then these more weakly coupled things will be more physically propagated out from that. I agree, it would be nice to have some numbers on that, or to be able to show figure right now.
Can you say that that's not just as a result of nearest neighbor? I mean, you'd expect that from nearest neighbor things, from just from close physical interactions. And if you want to say there's some big structure that's bigger than that, you could somehow compare this with what you'd expect based on local interactions.
But once you do the clustering, the things that are next to each other are no longer nearest neighbors.
In so space.
In space they are. But
yes, that's what I mean.
So you do see things that are highly, it would be good to be able to put a number on this. You do see things that are highly coupled, that are more physically removed. But generally, the things that are most highly coupled are spatially proximal. Yeah, okay,
Another side of the argument is that not all things that are spatial neighbors are in your correlations. So I guess you're finding some blue ones that are highly correlated.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that every pair of amino acids is correlated.
Right. So for example, like this guy and this guy, right, are not correlated with each other, and they're right next to each other in the tertiary structure. So it's definitely not that you're pulling out a kind of contact map, right? Yeah,
maybe I could try again. So, I pulled the statistics and everything, and there was interesting patterns. And I guess if these were just completely conserved sites, you don't see a pattern because they have to be co-evolving, right? Mm-hmm. To me, the interesting question is how does this happen, right? Because if you're going to be co-evolving, this suggests that you make a change here, and that forces a change, a corresponding covariance will change someplace else. So that suggests that the first mutation is possibly deleterious. Right? You you're getting sort of some kind of compensatory change somewhere else. Otherwise, there'd be no variance. So to me, that's the interesting question, is how does the natural pattern evolve? What would the population genetic mechanism, like how can this go forward?
So how do you build it?
Do you have any ideas on that?
I mean, it could be possible that it is going through, like, you get some of these mutations just through drift, and then you evolve some compensatory mutation, and these the particular groups of things can fix.
I mean, there are some models now that sort of attempt to deal with this.
So I'm wondering, inherently, this is a two-protein system. You're mapping your receptors on a single protein, but much of the time you're talking about two proteins there.
So here I'm only talking about a single protein. And we're inserting a second protein.
Well, you have the same problem.
Right, no, but I guess what I'm saying is that this is an allosteric, they're allosteric sites, but inherent to that allostery is an interaction with something else.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, I mean, you can compute a sector for the other protein, too. And so that's, I guess, like the examples are showing.
Yeah, no, but what
so
you're doing is
where you can find like the sectors kind of connect up, right?
You're calculating the existence of the allosteric sites and the transmission between them, but inherent to that is that it's being done by something, it's being activated by an interaction with something else.
But I guess the interesting thing is we find a lot of these surfaces even in the absence of any regulator. So they're sort of there and they come, the idea is that they're just part of the protein structure and how it's built, and you just get them kind of for free. Yeah.
I think the answer I most favor for Mike's question is the pattern of correlation evolves because fixed deleterious mutations, especially in asexual populations. So that if you, there are always deleterious mutations, right? Some low frequency in the population, typically probably everyone has in some steady state one or two. Get beneficial mutations, especially in asexual populations, somewhere else in the genome. So you drag deleterious alleles to fixation. There's some work from Michael Desai's lab that shows that you can make yeast evolve sexually or asexually. You can see that there is much more drag in the asexual population. So now you have a situation, you got fitter, but the HFR got worse. Because you accidentally drag some weakly deleterious mutation.
But if it's perfectly going well, it might not have gotten worse, right? You just sort of
tried. Yeah, but you know, in an asexual population, you can get dragged up by.
Yeah, there are other things.
Right. So now you have a protein that works less well than you would like. And you can improve the fitness by fixing that. As long as the target size for fixing whatever the deleterious effect is on VHFR and therefore on growth, is larger for pseudo reversion than for reversion. And it's making a mutation of another site. You will make a mutation of another site.
Yeah.
And now those positions will stay coupled for a while. And in particular, if the positions that lie outside the sector have one of two properties, either mutations there don't matter very much, or mutations there are often very bad, but they have to be precisely reverted. You have to go back to the original amino acid at that site. There will be no correlation. And it seems to me that compared to a sort of fluctuating environment model, where you have to make this somewhat bizarre proposal, you change one amino acid to make you a little better, but now you have to change another one to make you a lot better, which seems like a certain amount of intellectual hand-waving has been done to make this happen. This compensation for accidentally fixed deleterious models, deleterious mutation models, it all makes sense. And it's a film, you know, and you observe this happening in populations. So if you like, you know, it's a population genetics argument.
It starts to break down pretty quickly if you were careful to say it's an asexual organism. Because if you have recombination going on between the sites, then you have a real problem because you can't pull them together.
Right, and so, so in principle, a test of that would be that it should be easier to detect sectors in parts of the family. So imagine you have a part of the organismal universe where you know sex is widespread, and a different part where you know you mutation vastly exceeds recombination. And you had equivalent levels of sequence divergence in the two planes. The model I'm proposing would suggest that the sectors are easier to detect slash have bigger deviations from expectation from the guys where there was less exchange, for exactly the reason I just said.
That would be.
And that might just, it's at least worth thinking about whether it's worth trying to do that.
Another possibility is we're consistently finding mutations clustered. I mean, it's not incredibly common, but often when you get a mutation at one site, these are de novo, you'll get another one within about 40, 50 bases. That, you know, much higher probability than randomness. And so it could be that occasionally that if you just get lucky and get both mutations, and then boom, you just jumped over there. You don't even have to go through the deleterious state. You're talking about long time spans.
Yeah.
I assume every all the bugs you got in your analysis, like prokaryotes to eukaryotes in some cases?
Yeah, so in the case of the original DHFR alignment, it was prokaryotes to eukaryotes.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe that occasionally. Because then you don't even have the intermediate deleterious state, really.
If you don't have a combination. Because if you write the linkage between the two.
Yeah,
the
But, you know, if they're only 40, 50 bases apart, then
you might have time to reach the fixation
before. To a first approximation.
Well, maybe. Depends on the pollution size.
This is just like a question of scale. So, like, if you looked at a large collection, like, say, like the ribosome, would you expect to see sectors like slicing like all the way across it, or is there some like diffusion constant where eventually you're so far away it's
almost So I think that's a great question, and I mean that's one of the reasons we started looking at the flagellum, is basically to start to see like, do we see coevolution throughout the entire thing, or do we see it broken up into like smaller fragments or smaller pieces, right? Is it more modular or less modular? Yeah, I think that's something we're just starting to do.
And is there, I guess there's enough data to do, like, I mean, like, you could do it, right? Like, right now, but this moment, you could look at it. It's not like there's, you know, I'm overlooking some fact, like, oh, there's just not enough data to do it, but you actually could, right?
Yeah, you actually can start to do this because there's enough sequence genomic data now.
Yeah. Well, I think this idea is right. I mean, if you had a multimeric thing with two different proteins in one complex, there might be sectors that you would only see if you jointly analyze both of them together, right?
Yeah.
Why would that be true? Because even parts of it should still be coupled to each other, right?
Yeah, but it might be a lot weaker. I mean, you see a much bigger block, it might just stand out as a sector.
Yeah. So we.
It wouldn't necessarily have to be true. I'm just saying it might be true.
We started to look at this a little bit with that three protein system in the flagellum and asking, like, if you analyze individual genes alone versus if you analyze them together, do you pull out different groups of residues? And by and large, I would say what we see is that you get sort of the same sets of positions out in each of the three genes. But, you know, so far that's just a case study with three proteins, right? It needs to be more systematic. But so far it looks like the positions that are co-evolving between things are the same positions that are co-evolving within. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like one thing that's a really essential control for all that stuff is to take in the same genomes, proteins, and you believe you can put your hand on your heart and go, there's no way these guys interact with each other. And do a substantial number of pairs from that.
Yeah.
And that's what you see, because I actually once did this experiment with Scott for Euro3 and MAD2, and there's sectors that involve residues of those proteins.
Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, and the question is, can you distinguish things like that, which certainly is not biologically real,
from things that are, and
you know, it seems you have to do enough sampling so you can ask, like, okay, you know, and the slight problem is, there's not exactly an objective definition of a sector, right? And so then you start worrying about stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally agree. And so that's something that and part of doing this flagella analysis we're starting to do now is just basically make a lot of concatenations of things that we don't think interact and then try to see, can we pull out things that do versus things that don't? Yeah, totally agree.
So can I make a suggestion? So were you getting the target on the 30th, is that correct?
Yeah, it's not gonna be talk though. It's just anyone
discussion.
Wants to keep talking. And I'm gonna
propose. Can anybody go around this room?
We're 99% sure.
Yeah.
It's 3:00, I'm just saying, it's 3:05. Don't be the cookie.
Yes.
Saying it's cookie time.
So.
I personally would rather do it on the blackboards out there so people can come and go if they want. I don't want anybody feeling.
What's that, where?
You know, the ones that are out there in the courtyard.
That might be nice.
Is that all right?
So cookies.
We can commandeer them.
And then we'll just meander over.
Yeah. And don't come in.
Yeah, oh, thank you.
Yes.